in history in Australia, you can see, I think, a bit of a inkling of what things could look like here again, the kind of radical high points. And one of those is the one that the Communist Party of Australia first emerged out of. So I think that's the first reason to sort of look at this period, is to learn a bit of what Australia looks like in times of radicalisation. But as well as that, looking at the Communist Party is important, I think, because it's pretty hard to read about Australian labour history without coming across them. They're everywhere. But their politics, of course, over the course of its lifetime, changed a lot from where it started. It particularly became Stalinised with the kind of rise of Stalin's bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. But the early kind of more radical roots and revolutionary roots of the Communist Party, I think, are worth looking into. So I'm going to give some context for that and context for the formation of it, and then Duncan's going to go through the founding itself and how that happened. The first thing, I wanted to start with is World War I, which in Australia, like, I went to the library to research this talk, there's a million books on Gallipoli. It seems impossible to count the amount of books that there are about, like, random specific battles, Christmas Day as well, like, all of these different particular moments on the front and in the war. But here in Australia, there was a huge radicalisation that was generated by World War I. And that wasn't immediate. At the start of the war, there wasn't this kind of widespread radical opposition to it particularly. There's a handful of radicals and socialists who opposed it and tried to generate opposition to the war. But on the whole, there was kind of, you know, nationalism and patriotism in Australia that meant there wasn't immediate mass opposition. But that quite quickly changed for a bunch of reasons. Partly the war put downward pressure on wages. As it wore on, it became more obvious how kind of terrible it was, and workers in Australia were suffering because of the war effort itself. And so the particular high point of all of this was what's known as the Great Strike. There were all different kind of, rallies that began to happen around the question of conscription, ending the war and so on. But the Great Strike was the kind of high point of it. 100,000 workers went out on strike at the high point of this kind of moment in 1917. And it was quite a radical strike. Workers didn't just kind of go out for a few days then go back into their workplaces. They were out in many places for months. And as well as that, it was a strike that was a rebellion against the union officials for a whole period. So there's this quite funny quote by E.J. Kavanagh, who was the secretary of the New South Wales Labor Council at the time. He said, for the officials, the difficulty wasn't getting men to come out on strike, it was keeping them in. So the struggle to keep people from going out on strike, but they kind of resisted that and went out for a whole period. And this kind of was combined, it was a strike particularly around the economic questions, but it combined in with the political question of the war. So at the same time as the strike was going on, you would have meetings opposing conscription to World War I, which were being defended by armed workers, for example, and attacked by right-wing thugs. Eventually this strike was defeated by the trade union officials who kind of came to the head of it, said, you know, ended up kind of running the strike and then defeated it and organised the sellout. And a key kind of lesson out of that for a lot of people was, well, there wasn't some way of having a nationally cohered, more radical leadership that could lead the strike to success and go against the officials in a more organised way. And so instead they were kind of able to fill this vacuum and wind it up. But even after that strike was wound up, the radicalisation that was produced by the war kept going on. So in 1919, there's this particular example I wanted to give because I was so struck by it. In Townsville, don't even miss Townsville. Yeah. Today it's like pretty terrible, really. but in 1919, meat workers in Townsville went on strike and they didn't just go on strike, they seized the city of Townsville. So while they were out on their pickets, mounted troops with whips went and would flog the workers on the pickets. Police drew revolvers on the pickets. And when there was a mass demonstration in support of this strike, it was shot at with rifles. And a number of people were, like, wounded by the bullets. And in response to that, though, the next day the workers came out and they raided all of these stores to get weapons and then they took control of the city, which is, like, that's Australia. That's the country we live in. And the military were asked to put down the strike, and they said, no, we don't want to get involved in this. Seems a bit messy and dangerous. And there's this, then afterwards, police were being sent in to crush this strike. How do they get there? Trains. So the railway workers said that I've read this lovely account. It's very little you can read about this, but there's this account that's like written in handwriting by this railway worker, this young railway worker who participated in it. He said, a comrade asked me what we all thought about having a mass meeting. Sure we should, said Jake. And so we set up a committee for defence of the strike, and then we blocked all the trains. This is kind of very matter of fact, like, here's what you do when you're trying to organise the defence of a town that is being run by meat workers. And so this very kind of radical period in Australia was characterised by like a real high point of workers' militancy, quite a lot of consciousness about the political questions of the war, for example. But unlike places like Russia, Italy and so on, there wasn't a kind of mass communist or socialist current that was able to cohere it emerge as a like leadership of this struggle. So in a lot of ways, it had a kind of like lower political level than some of the radicalizations in those countries at the same time people might be used to reading about. I want to turn a bit to the question of the organized left. There's a slide that says, yeah, nice. So, I want to start with the Wobblies, the IWW. People might have seen these a bit before. And in Australia, they were very significant. There were quite a large revolutionary organisation effectively around this period. And they started off quite small. So there's this account by Bill Beattie, a member, who says, the bulk of our membership was composed of bush and construction workers who travelled by necessity. When two or more members found themselves on a job together, they organised study and reading classes, all workers welcome. And so they started off as this kind of small group based around, this is one big union, based around one big union politics. So this idea that the way that you're going to get rid of capitalism is by uniting workers into one big industrial union that exists in all the workplaces around the country. And then through that, that's going to bring about a revolutionary general strike and then get rid of capitalism. And during the radicalisation I just talked about, you can imagine all of these workers are fucking seizing Townsville, shutting down the railways. They've got the great strike. The question is, you know, what do you get involved in that can take these things forward? And so in that period, the IWW kind of grew out of 1916 and early 1917, the kind of radicalisation. Particularly their paper had a bigger circulation. So a bit earlier than that, more at the start of the war is when they start to grow. And their paper had a circulation of around 1,500, which is quite large. And then the readership would often, it'd be passed between people, so it went up to around 30,000 or 45,000. The membership role is kind of disputed, but the guy who was, I quoted before, he said it was 55,000, and their dues-paying members were 11,000 people. Other historians have said it was more like a couple of thousand, a few thousand. But the influence of the IWW went much beyond people who were just members of theirs and to kind of, workers around them who were quite influenced by one big union kind of politics. And the Sydney Morning Herald reported in 1916, they said it's more or less constant followers in Sydney alone number between 20,000 and 30,000. So you can get a bit of a sense of the scale of it from those things. In terms of the IWW, though, you can think it's like, okay, there's this whole period of radicalisation. Well, why weren't they able to just come to the head of it and lead it to have this one general strike that brings about a revolution? And one of the key things, apart from the problems with that general political philosophy, was also the problems of their form of organisation. So they, would do things like educate workers about revolutionary politics, struggle around day-to-day issues like wages and working conditions. They would often be, the best kind of unionists in their workplace were the members of the IWW. But the politics in the organisation sort of limited its capacity to survive once it was turned on in a serious way by the Australian ruling class. And so during World War One, right as it's kind of coming into its height, it's then cracked down on. And they didn't have particular plans for that repression. They didn't go into hiding or anything. There was this account I read of someone who'd been in the IWW, and he said, yeah, one of the problems with what we did is that for a bit, there was a period where if you were an orator of the IWW, you could go to jail for a night. Then that turned into 6 months. You'd go to jail for 6 months. Well, once that happened, we kept acting like it was one night. We kept going out into the streets. But they opened their membership rolls to make public everyone who was a member. That's a surefire way. Well, there's people who are going to go to prison for 6 months. That's a surefire way of scaring people away. And the way that Verity Bergman put it was that a retreat needs a general staff just as much as an advance does. So if you're going to have an advance, you need a serious organisation that's able of cohering that, taking it forwards. But also, if you come under serious repression the way they did, where their meetings being bashed up, they're all being sent to prison, well, you need a general staff. You need a serious organisation that's capable of reorienting, saying, okay, we need to change tack. We need to do something differently and just weather this repression and figure out a way of doing that. The Bolsheviks in Russia, for example, were able to do that. They had periods where they would go underground, effectively, and then they would come back out again when they realised that there was more democratic space again. The IWW, they weren't capable of that, and it meant that they were just totally smashed. And by the kind of, yeah, particularly around 1917 as the Russian Revolution's breaking out, they were, yeah, all but decimated, and particularly into sort of 1918, the 20s, when the Communist Party is formed. But they left a few important questions on the left. On the one hand, how do you build a type of organisation that can withstand repression? What do you do? How do you organise yourselves in the future? But also, Verity Bergman, she talks about it as IWWism. It's often called one big union politics, that political current that says we need to unite everyone in one big union, and that's the thing that's going to, take us forwards to the revolution and so on. That general political idea remained an extremely dominant current among Australian workers. So Australia had the most unionised working class in the world at this point, and most of those people were syndicalists of some stripe. They thought this thing about the one big union and radical trade unionism. And these ideas, yeah, they had a very kind of broad influence on both the Australian working class but also on the existing socialist groups. So often, it's interesting, often syndicalism is associated with anarchism, the way that you just come across it online and stuff. But this time it was like, during a socialist group, you thought of yourself as you're a syndicalist. They were syndicalists as well. And I want to give a little bit of a sense of that. Do you want to go on to the next? Oh, yeah, that one. No, that's okay. This is the Victorian Socialist Party, which was one of the biggest socialist organisations that kind of preceded the Communist Party. This is them having a kind of like mass meeting to hear Tom Mann revolutionary speak in 1906. And that organisation, by the time of 1918, had around 640 members. In this period that's pictured, they had around 2,000. So they kind of go down a bit, but they're still, significant as an organisation. They also, though, drift to the right politically. So they become effectively kind of a left reformist organisation. But the more left-wing people in the Victorian Socialist Party consider themselves to be syndicalists and were much closer to the kind of politics of the IWW. Then as well, you can go to the next slide if you want. This was interesting. This is a fundraising Christmas card that they made, which is about fundraising for free speech. That is pretty sick. So that's the VSP. This was put out by them. There's a whole series of other different groups as well that existed. This was a period where the left was in a lot of turmoil because there's this radicalisation. And so it's all different groups are kind of springing up and going away again quite rapidly. Another one was the Australian Socialist Party. They were had been fairly big but were smaller by the time that the Communist Party was actually formed, and Duncan's going to talk more about them. But then they also, for a whole period, they sort of were more syndicalist and characterised by that. And then there's also the Trades Hall Reds, which are these kind of group of like quite radical trade union officials who were, bureaucrats in different unions, but who considered themselves to be far more left-wing and far more radical than the mainstream trade union bureaucracy. And they, alongside these socialist groups, were part at all different times of trying to form one big unions. So there are all these different projects that were, this is the new one big union, and they would try and form that. So very dominant in terms of the politics of the Australian left. So 1917, going back, you have the Great Strike. This is the kind of situation of the working class, very syndicalist. What else Someone tell me, what else happens in 1917?
Russia.
So, well, something happens in Russia. The revolution happens in Russia and the insurrection. Workers take power for the first time. So, you know, in Australia you have this great strike that's defeated. In Russia, workers take power. And the sense of it, Victor Serge, who was kind of a syndicalist and then communist, he says the thing that he says immediately after the Russian Revolution, he says, we've known how to win. We can never forget that. The Russians among us know what it is to take the world into their hands, to set the railways running and the factories working, to defend bombarded cities, to establish production plants. And you can see how influential that would be for people who have, we've got this mass workers movement, but we keep getting defeated. In Russia, they fucking won. Well, how do we then get influenced by that? How do we take their lessons? But that wasn't a sort of automatic process. It partly, you know, Russia, it's the revolution is quickly bombarded. It's quite hard to get word out. They don't have the internet. If only they had Zoom. But they don't. And so instead word kind of slowly trickles through into Australia. And in Australia, there's this whole process of trying to figure out, well, what are they actually doing, Russia? What are the political lessons? And how do we take those here? But one thing that people did note, there was a party. They had the Bolshevik Party, a communist party. And so that was one of the earliest kind of questions that started to come up in Australia is, how do we have a communist party? And there's one of the kind of groupings that helped to get the word out in Australia was the Russian exile community, who'd been through kind of earlier periods of the Russian Revolution, but were now in Australia. And as well as that, the Bolsheviks had an attitude in that period, the Russian revolutionaries, of trying to spread the revolution internationally, help the working class in other countries. And so they appointed one of these kind of like left-wing revolutionary exiles in Australia as the Soviet consul, because you can do that when you take power. You can choose who the consul is. And so then he started to link up with all different kind of people from those socialist parties that I talked about, from the ex-IWW as well, the kind of fragments of it that existed. So in Melbourne, there were these syndicalists, Guido Baracci and Percy Laidlaw, who ran kind of the last fragments of the IWW. He started to link up with them. In Broken Hill, Mick Considine and Percy Brookfield, different members of the Victorian Socialist Party as well. But in Sydney in particular, there was more fertile ground for founding something more serious. So in Sydney, the IWW had been the strongest. They'd kind of been more organised for a period. But also the more left-wing variants of these socialist groups had a more serious following in Sydney. So it had kind of the best groundwork to form some type of communist party. So I'm going to finish up. I'm going to let Duncan kind of go on from here. But there's a few things that in terms of setting the scene, I'll just go through them again. So it's like on the one hand you have this kind of quite radical period with high working class militancy. You have the defeat of the Great Strike, and the crushing of the IWW, these kind of defeats that they suffer, that then open up the question of what type of organisation do you need to win. And then also you have all of these different socialists and syndicalists of different stripes who'd been organised, but now the Russian Revolution starts pulling them towards some form of Bolshevism, communism. What did they do in Russia? We're going to try and figure that out. But, yeah, I'll let Duncan go.
So the founders of the actual CPA, this group that was, as Jazz was discussing, came from this very diverse grouping of different revolutionaries and socialists from many different tendencies across Australia. So it ranged from the ex-IWW members who'd been jailed in 1916 and 1917, like Tom Glynn. The head of the Trades Hall Reds, Jock Garden. He was the is sort of very much a manoeuvrer and a bureaucrat, despite his despite the fact that he was trying to form a communist party. There's people like Adela Pankhurst, who is, even though not the leader of the Victorian Socialist Party, probably their most high-profile member. She'd led, like, marches of women, which had, like, trashed stores in Melbourne for, like, against, like, high prices of food during the war. There was Tom Walsh, who was a militant seamen's leader, who had basically led, like, a big national strike of seamen that had won substantive gains in the teeth of like massive resistance from the government. So it was quite a, you know, I guess there's a lot of leading figures, a lot of very, qualified militants involved, but it was also quite a diverse and in some ways many contradictory tendencies. So the group that actually, the most important group was the Trades All Reds, led by Jock Garden, but the Australian Socialist Party, which was the one of the largest groups in Sydney, actually hosted the meeting in its hall in Sydney. So that diversity quickly proved untenable, despite the attraction of communism and the grappling that of the new, you know, grappling with new ideas that these people were going through. Very quickly, the Australian Socialist Party split off. They called themselves the Communist Party. It was only in 1922, so basically almost 2 years later, after the party was founded in October of 1920, that the that split was reconciled and they rejoined together. And the IWW, many of the IWW people like Tom Glynn, split off as well in 1922. So given that the party went through all these like early splits, and in fact it stagnated quite a lot really in its essentially first 10 years before it was like Stalinized during the Great Depression, I guess there's one of the questions people might have is like, well, what's the point of discussing these people? And I agreed with the thing that Jazz said at the start. Well, actually, we should recognize that the horrible politics of Stalinism that later became dominant in the CPA, firstly, was not a reflection of like the actual radical tradition in Australian socialism, but also it was not actually the politics of the early party that was set up. And it's important, I think, to rescue that because, these people, for all their problems, they were trying to establish a revolutionary party in Australia and to actually lead a successful revolution. So what were the crucial elements, the politics of the Comintern that were being taken up by the Australian socialists? I've tried to summarise them into three fundamentals. Firstly, smashing the state, mass action, and then an orientation to winning the majority of the workers. So these elements distinguish the new politics of communism from what the existing Australian socialist left believed, particularly because it challenged a really fundamental ideological understanding that that socialists had at the time, which divided basically like the methods of achieving socialism between the industrial struggle and the political struggle. Pretty much every single one of these people, from the IWW to the ASP, to the Socialist Labour Party, as another group which Jazz didn't have time to mention, they all saw these struggles as running along separate lines. Essentially, it means that, there's the political struggle, which is basically when you run for parliaments, you know, you pass legislation, maybe you, like, propagandise for things. But then there's the industrial struggle, which is basically when workers at their place of work take action to fight for their rights. So the communism really was a significant challenge to that because it actually argued that these two things were totally inseparable, and it was only through workers' activity at their place of work that could actually be, you know, and also taking up political questions at their place of work as workers, that they could lead to revolutionary consciousness and overthrow capitalism. So in terms of smashing the state, there'd been, quite a few socialists, like the people which Jazz went over, the Australian Socialist Party, the Socialist Labour Party. They had argued for revolution, but they had no real idea what they meant by that. It was left very vague, and particularly none of them thought, or none of them articulated clearly, that there needed to be a workers' state established. That was the thing that was a new idea that came about through the people taking up what was being put forward by the Comintern. In particular, the early CPA like took the State and Revolution by Lenin with gusto, and they saw that as their, like, I guess, like probably the most fundamental text of the early party. And if people have read State and Revolution, Lenin assesses the state as the means by which one class oppresses another and concludes that, therefore, the existing state has to be destroyed and the workers substitute their own form of state in its place. So the thing that most inspired these early Australian communists was the idea of the Soviets, in other words, the workers' councils, which was the main element of the Russian Revolution, besides the party. The earliest Comintern publications to arrive in Australia, which, just showed people on the previous slide, they... sorry, I missed my function. They included Lenin's immediate tasks to the Soviet government, Radek's Socialism from Science to Action, and the Manifesto of the Third International drafted by Trotsky. And they all appeared around the end of 1919. But they were particularly taken, the early communists, by the description of the Soviets that was in one of Radek's pamphlets. And it's like one of those pamphlets which unfortunately just is relatively unknown to history. But I'm just going to quote from this this pamphlet because it was very, I think it really summarizes like why even today socialists look towards the idea of Soviets. So he says, "The idea of Soviets is as simple as one can imagine it to be. Only history creates such splendid crystallizations. In the factory, the slaves of capital worked. The factory is bound by a thousand threads to other factories with the whole economic life of the locality. It is dependent on the transportation of the locality, on the factories which work upon its semi-manufactured goods, or from which it receives them. It depends on also on all the factories in the same branch of industry, and the last analysis on the economic life of the entire country. The representation of the factory is consequently political and economic, the cell of the state mechanism. The form of the worker delegate councils, which can always be re-elected, which always return to the native soil of the factory, this form will be the one with which the proletariat will conquer capitalism and with which it will become capable of accomplishing socialism." So, like, with that sort of description of the Soviets as this idea of, like, yeah, workers' control of production, workers' control of society, you can sort of see why the idea that that was what was happening in Russia was very compelling to Australian socialists. So a few other things just to get a sense of, well, why the communists weren't arguing for, you know, any sort of Stalinist society. They argued that the workers' state meant an immense expansion of democracy, being democracy for the many poor with restrictions for the few rich. And they saw as well that the Workers' Council was significant because it connected both the political and economic spheres, understanding that to be fundamentally more radical than any union or parliamentary fraction could be. So then the other factor I mentioned, mass action. So Jazz went through a bunch of really good examples of how mass action had already been a feature of Australian politics before the establishment of the Communist Party. But it was something that was theorised by actually the politics that were coming out of the Comintern. So when the early CPA people were trying to understand what this concept, they were drawing from the Bolsheviks, but also European communists like Anton Panikek. But they actually found their clearest explanation in the writings of US communists. So they actually quoted directly an article from the US that laid out that mass action was direct mass participation in an extra-parliamentary medium directed towards a political goal. And they argued that the culminating event in the mass struggle was the insurrection that overthrows the capital state and places the Soviets in power. So, yeah, as this slide sort of just shows a few examples as well, besides the general strike in 1917 or workers seizing arms in 1919 in Townsville, there was also, in 1923 in Melbourne, there was this massive riot basically instigated by a police strike where tens of thousands of people went onto the streets and, like, fought against the scab cops that were created by the government to maintain order. So with those kind of things as, like, a background, the idea of the CPA's idea of mass action was an interpretation of these struggles and an argument for how socialists should relate to them. They said that any large-scale workers' action, even if it did not aim beyond purely economic goals, was mass action because it would come into confrontation with the capitalist state. But then the role of communists was to intervene in those struggles, to explain the political connections between their struggles that they're going on, the significance of them, and why they would only be able to be resolved ultimately through revolution. That differed a lot from how the existing left understood workers' struggle. The Australian Socialist Party basically said that workers going on strike was like a labour of Sisyphus, because actually only when you had a revolution would the real changes happen. The Socialist Labour Party saw that the two spheres of going on strike and working in parliament and actually being political were different and separate. The IWW concepts of direct action, which is basically the idea that, workers' power on the job is the source of workers' strength and can be the key to their liberation, that was pretty much the closest to the concept of mass action. But the crucial difference was sort of like the reiteration of Marx's maxim from the Communist Manifesto that every class struggle is also a political struggle. The communists had a duty to connect workplace struggles to the need for revolution but also other political questions. And the IWW did do this. You know, we're not just trying to make out that they didn't ever talk about things that weren't just the workplace issues, but the main thing is that they did not have a political theory that actually connected these things up. Whereas the mass action idea was that actually every struggle against oppression, you know, whether it was questions of like women's rights, whether it was issues like the war, yeah, whether it was the police deserting their posts and provoking a huge confrontation in the streets of Melbourne, these are all political questions and they could all be brought in together and strengthened through workers' power at work. So the idea that this what the communists call the organic mode of struggle of the workers, which is the strike, as the basis of how political change could happen, that was what meant that the CPA, I think, overcame the division between industrial and political methods, at least in theory. And they struggled to implement this practically, but I think it was very important as a step forward in their ideas. So the other thing that is, I guess, like, usually boiled down to mean to be what Leninism is a concept people might have heard of it, democratic centralism. Now, this is usually a theory of organization, apparently, that Lenin held and was almost and is usually seen to be, I guess, like the main thing that defines what communism is as a theory, as opposed to just like Marx's ideas. So historians like Stuart McIntyre, Verity Bergman and many others argue that the CPA, because they held to this Leninist idea, they were basically like authoritarians, that they thought that there should be an enlightened revolutionary minority that would seize power, because of this idea that you needed some kind of like, vanguard party or something to seize power by hook or crook. Now, the problem with that argument is that the historians who argue that can't actually point towards any evidence in the CPA's itself for that project. And the early Comintern publications, which I like highlight on the screen earlier, actually don't talk much about the form of revolutionary organization. So the way that these people make this argument is they say, Lenin wrote a book in 1902 called What Is to Be Done, where he made all these terrible arguments about, you know, the workers are too stupid to overthrow capitalism. They need to be led by the hand by the minority of intellectuals who will overthrow capitalism on behalf of the workers. And now this talk isn't about what is to be done, but there's like actually been a lot of scholarship and work by socialists that has pretty much totally disproven this interpretation. But the thing that's hilarious about the Australian situation was that what is to be done was not translated from Russian until 1929. So I've got it up on the screen there in its original translation just to make sure that's what the Australian socialists would have gotten out of it if they could even have accessed it. And Simonov, who was the consul, the Soviet consul, which Jazz referenced, he played an important role in bringing together the CPA. But he actually, and he was aware of what is to be done, but he didn't actually know what its arguments were. He hadn't been a Bolshevik in 1902. He actually wrote a book in 1919 for Australian socialists where he argued that the Bolshevik form of organisation was strong, local, independent centres where the central committee was to be as much responsible to the other committees as the other committees were to be responsible to the central body. And actually he said the Mensheviks were the ones who were for a central, authoritative and responsible executive committee whose decisions should be obeyed by all members. So he actually said the Mensheviks were the ones who had this sort of authoritarian system. So, of course, the CPA was for a revolutionary party, but it's just to point out that what that meant to them was actually about the politics, what kind of party, as in a party that is actually for overthrowing capitalism, is for mass action, is committed to overthrowing the state. But they did as Jazz said, they also wanted to understand how did the Bolsheviks organise. So they reprinted documents from the 1920 Comintern Congress. They argued that the CPA should not be a group of intellectuals or professional revolutionaries, but the most advanced, class-conscious, and the most revolutionary section of the working class. The party would, you know, strive to understand the entirety of historical development of the workers, to defend their interests as a class as a whole and not as of a section. And they also understood that the revolutionaries outside of revolutionary situation would be in a minority, but that the goal of the party was to win leadership in the working class. So I guess then the question is, well, how do they actually go in applying these politics? they had this idea that there'd be workers' mass action, that there'd be a new state established based on workers' councils, and they wanted to win the majority of workers to this view. Well, the sad story is, as I sort of talked about when I started, the CPA wasn't very successful. They started off as the largest party on the left when they were first founded, basically because most other parties joined them. But then by 1925, they had less than 100 active members. And this was not just a disaster for the CPA, but also the broader left, because it had gone from that thing that, like Jazz talks about, where you had thousands of people in all these different kinds of organizations to basically, a one party, the CPA, and less than 100 people in it. So the CPA was pretty a dismal failure. Was this because of their politics, or was it because they failed to apply them properly? I guess I think that it was some elements of both. They did, I think, have politics that were in advance of what was already existing on the Australian left. But some of the Comintern's political soft spots became fatal mistakes in Australia, particularly about how to relate to the reformist Labor Party and also the trade union bureaucracy. These were already the most challenging questions the left in Australia faced before the Russian Revolution, and the traditions that had been built up before that did not have good answers. On the other hand, the CPA did not pursue the strategy of mass action, as in workers' struggle from below being the basis upon which their immediate conditions could be improved, their consciousness raised, and the ground laid for future struggle. Instead, the early leaders of the party, so particularly people like Jock Garden, who are trade union bureaucrats, pursued a variety of shortcuts, such as attempting to establish the one big union, and they didn't do that through class struggle that brought workers together at the grassroots. They did it through congresses where they met with other bureaucrats. They also did things like go to the Comintern congresses and say how great they were, and they controlled thousands and thousands of workers, and the revolution was going to happen any day in Australia. And I think most damagingly, they tried to work within the ALP. So it was the political weaknesses of the CPA which allowed, Jock Garden in particular, to pursue these schemes to such disastrous ends. And there's also the question of the Comintern itself was politically influenced by the Bolsheviks, and that meant that they didn't necessarily have precise clarity about the role of union officials as a social layer. It wasn't that the Bolsheviks and the broader Comintern weren't against union officials or didn't have a critique of them, but they underestimated the challenge that communists would have in exercising control over communist union leaders. For instance, in a polemic that the CPA, early CPA, published against socialists splitting the existing unions, which was a big argument at the time, the IWW was for that, for instance, they argued that the discipline of the party, of the CPA, would be enough to keep union leaders in line. But what about a tiny party like the CPA, a shrinking party as well? In fact, that was like a total illusion that could actually be successful. And the inexperience of the Comintern, combined with the weakness of Australian syndicalist ideas, which generally saw in unions the vehicles for revolutionary change. So while Australian syndicalists, for instance, formed rank-and-file committees such as Broken Hill, they did not generalise out from that experience a theory of how such structures, so how workers' rank-and-file organisation, could be built up to counteract the influence of the officials. The CPA also did not organise rank-and-file committees at this time either. And that's really, I think, because the union officials in the party were already, directing the sort of struggle. The other political weakness was in relation to Labor. Australian socialists had been divided on how to relate to Labor before the CPA was established. Essentially, you had people like the Victorian Socialists. They would join Labor and try and, move it to the left. And then there were people like the Australian Socialist Party who said that, we could never involve ourselves with Labor and our role should be criticising them from the outside. The CPA basically oscillated between those two attitudes. They originally were outside of Labor, but then they joined the party in 1923. So the Comintern, I think, actually had the right idea about how to relate to reformists. Comrades will know about the United Front strategy, the idea being that communists should work with reformists in common struggles short of revolution in order to win workers to revolutionary politics and leadership by showing their superiority to the reformists in practice through those struggles. And while the CPA knew about the United Front, because that was, 1921, they interpreted it as justification for their attempts to join the ALP. And the Comintern was actually guided by the CPA in relation to this decision, so they actually endorsed it. So they basically let it happen. And So as Mick says in his recent MLR article on this issue, which is definitely worth a read because there's pretty much nothing else written about the early Communist Party, whether or not it was a good idea for the whether or not it was admissible in principle, rather, for the CPA to join the Labor Party, it was suicidal for the young Communist Party with just like a few hundred people. Most of their members who joined the ALP didn't function as disciplined communists, but simply leftists in the broader party. When the ALP leadership unsurprisingly turned against the CPA and expelled them, the CPA was nearly destroyed as most communists just melted into the ALP. All right, so just summing up a bit. So the CPA in its early years held to the politics of the Comintern. That was not Stalinism. These were a significant advance on what the pre-existing left held to. They tore up the straitjacket of older socialists that argued that there was a division between industrial and political struggle to fight for socialism. They argued that mass action was the only way to workers to attain revolutionary consciousness, that needed to establish workers' councils to smash the state and to eventually have workers in power. But the important thing, I guess, about that was that they fucked up quite badly. The major issues that actually confronted the left weren't solved by these ideas that the Comintern, that they got from the Comintern. They were primarily about how to relate to the union officials and the Labor Party. So that means that there's a lot for us, I guess, in learning about this early period to take from the CPA, rather. Things like learning about how workers' rank and file activity can be a bulwark against the conservatism of union officials, that the United Front is the best method for revolutionary parties to relate to Reformist Party. But these sort of tactical lessons from the Comintern weren't really taken up by the CPA and pretty much wrecked the early party. So I guess, like, just the last thing, I think that the early CPA is in many respects a tragedy, but the fact that thousands of Australian workers looked to revolutionary politics, were inspired by the Russian Revolution, and joined this party should tell us that this kind of radicalization can't happen again. So the important thing for us is not to repeat our forebears' mistakes, but to learn from them so that their struggles will not be in vain.